I've got a few people in the audience down here that I'm calling kind of the sub-panelists, and I'm going to get to all of you shortly. But I think we will start because we just talked about the Medicaid expansion in Idaho and how that hasn't happened yet. So we have Tim Jordan. Tim, can you come up to the mic just briefly? And I don't need you to talk too long, but now you're working with the group Reclaim Idaho.
Right.
You're trying to actually move this into the public realm where the voters can maybe push the state to do the Medicaid expansion, correct?
Right, yeah. I'm glad I didn't have to persuade people here about the benefits of Medicaid. But, you know, I just wanted to say kind of a little bit about my experience and why I think it's important. And, you know, the reason I'm here is because I work in Spokane. I see a lot of kids from Idaho because, you know, of our proximity to northern Idaho. And I see a lot of issues with their parents when they come. And you know, Obamacare and the Affordable Care is that act. It's not going to change much in the next few years. And what we need to do is try to make sure that things don't get worse. And that's really what's going to have to happen over the next 3 years. The Reclaim Idaho is a way of doing that. It's getting, you know, Medicaid coverage for people in Idaho. A lot of the kids I see. They come and their parents have medical issues that are not covered by insurance. As you know, children's Medicaid, the CHIP program, the Children's Health Insurance Program, covers most children. But a lot of times their parents, and sometimes foster parents, sometimes disabled grandparents are taking care of these kids, and they don't have the coverage they need. And it makes their life a lot harder and makes it harder for them to deal with their children's issues. Just because they have to worry about that. And there was actually a recent study that showed that if parents have Medicaid coverage, their children are more likely to have it. So if the parents don't have that coverage, they don't even seek out Medicaid coverage that's available. So, and that's a big issue with me is covering children. Even though the Medicaid expansion in Idaho would just be adults.
So you're specifically, you're working, this Reclaim Idaho campaign is actually trying to get signatures to put it on the ballot,
right,
correct?
Right, right.
And where are you at on that campaign right now? How far, how many signatures do you have to go?
We have, I think, like 29,000. We need to get to 56 or 59,000, somewhere in there. And that's one reason I'm here is to recruit people, especially healthcare providers like myself, to work on this campaign. Because as you know, the hospitals in Spokane would get a lot of benefit if more people in Idaho had Medicaid coverage because they come here, especially to the specialty clinics where I work, and they need that. They would make a huge benefit for Spokane. So what I want people in Spokane to do is actually work on the campaign if you can, Reclaim Idaho, and also contribute to that if you could, because it's we only have 30 more days and we got a lot of signatures to get. So that's the main reason I'm here, is to recruit people.
And does it just direct the legislature to approve it, or what does it say?
No,
exactly?
Well, it says that you have to put it on the ballot.
Okay.
And as you know, I just wanted to relate my experience in Arizona, where I worked for 10 years. Arizona was not a Medicaid expansion state at first, but they were finally persuaded to do it, and it was a bipartisan support. That's the only reason it passed. I don't think that bipartisan support is going to be present in Idaho. So that's why we have to get it on the ballot and give the people a choice. I don't think that it's going to be a bipartisan, popular thing in Idaho ever. Mm-hmm. So that's why we're doing it. We want to get it on the ballot, give the people a choice, which we think they'll choose it. I just want to also relate my experience in Arizona. Arizona was the only state that got rid of the Children's Health Initiative program for 5 years, it was off and on. A lot of times they didn't have it. And again, in order to save money, believe it or not. And because the philosophical differences, and it certainly wasn't a money thing, finally in 2015, a bill was passed that said that if you have the Children's Health Insurance Program, you get 100% federal coverage in a state like Arizona, which is low income. And they still didn't do it. So finally, after the medical community and the people in Arizona got behind it and just pummeled the legislature, including a letter by me and the other people, finally, after a year of this, they passed it, and they passed the Children's Health Insurance Initiative in Arizona. So, it's these deep-set philosophical issues in politicians that are just not going to change, and you can't blame them. It's just that they're not going to change, and that's why you need something like this initiative to get on the ballot.
Okay, great. Well, thanks so much for your time, and grateful for you coming down and talking to us. I think now I've got a couple more sub-panelists, and I'm going to get to you guys pretty quick here. I just want to. We've got a couple of the audience questions. I'll take a couple of these, and then I'll go back to my scripts. So here's one of the questions. And for people who missed open enrollment on the health benefit exchange but are over income for Medicaid, where can they access low-cost health care to pay as they go until the next open enrollment? Any of you guys? Is that an easy question to answer? Or?
No, that's not an easy question for me to answer.
Yeah.
Well, again, you know, we see anybody regardless of ability to pay, and
right.
You know, it's so that is at least one solution. I don't know if the question was broader as far as the enrollment, and I'll defer to others.
And we see people regardless of their ability to pay as well.
Yeah. Yeah, and since we're on that topic, and you know, when I asked Aaron about that, very flexible payment schedule. I mean, you even mentioned the $5 a month kind of thing. I mean, how easy is that for major hospitals to do, to say, we'll go ahead and treat you, but we'll make arrangements to pay? I mean, is that something that can be set up? Or
it can be set up, and we also help. It depends on, you know, people's income levels, because we have charity care policies, and depending on where people are on those, they can either have their entire bill paid or written off, or they end up having to, you know, make payments, or sometimes people just need to have access to a banking institution that will also set really low payments up for them.
Okay. Mike, is that question, I mean, does that fit in at all with those short-term plans we were talking about? I mean, I know that you said you'd like to limit them to the 90 days, correct, rather than isn't the federal government asking to move these to 364 days? But would that be an option for somebody like this?
It would be an option.
If it were affordable.
but if you... Many of these people, the reason they're making the acquisition is because they have a pre-existing condition, and they're going to be excluded from being able to get the insurance.
Okay.
And one of the most popular things with the Affordable Care Act are the pre-existing conditions that they have that coverage. You know, you ask the question, you know, what happens? You know, if somebody's caught in that dilemma of missing the open enrollment. That's one where the federal government's cut back on the open period where you can advertise, so it's been shrunk down now, so there's a small, narrower window right now, but it's part of the incentive that all of us should have and say, you know what, I'm going to really step out there and make sure I have insurance, because bad luck can happen to anybody at any time, and if that's the case, I want to make sure I have health insurance. But if you always leave the door open and say, you've got another avenue here that you can follow that's going to be a way where you can get insurance coverage, you're going to dissuade people from buying it until they need it. You need to make sure that people have it year round. And I think you might not have the penalty, the tax penalty any longer, but at the same time, you still have the penalty that applies, presumably, that if you have bad luck and you don't have health insurance, you run a very serious risk. If you need for chronic conditions, or you're in the, if you're being being treated for metastatic cancer, whatever it might be that really requires significant intervention, those are going to be very tough to be able to pick up. You're fortunate that we have hospitals like Providence that'll step in, but realistically, there's a limit on what the hospitals can wind up doing. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're already subsidizing Idaho, Northern Idaho, because they don't have the Medicaid program. It'd be interesting to ever break it out and find how much is it's costing Providence in Spokane because of the failure for Idaho to address the expansion of the Medicaid program. I dare say it's not insignificant.
Hmm. Michael, you had a point.
Yeah,
on
that same
topic.
I was just going to say two things. So the commissioner's right, and it reminds me, and I'm sure a lot of you have seen it, but I always laugh when I see the home security alarm commercials on TV, and I always think, why are people buying a home security system after they've been robbed? Shouldn't you get the security before the guy breaks in? So, and the commissioner's right. There are a lot of people who they'll go without insurance until something bad happens, and then they'll try to get the insurance. And that is just not the way to go about it. Mm-hmm. We're fortunate that we've changed greatly how people view insurance and the importance it has in their lives over the last 5 years in this state. And that's due to a lot of hard work by a lot of people in this audience as well as around the state, and we should be proud of that. And the other thing is, too, is that it should be noted there are legitimate reasons why you could get insurance outside of open enrollment. And it's important that people do know about those. If you have a child or you're married or you get laid off from your job, or so there are special enrollment periods that are allowed for people.
Are there?
Yes.
Okay.
Related to specific conditions that are laid out by the federal government. And, so there are opportunities for people. However, I don't want to make light of it in terms of like the dog ate my homework, but, that isn't going to pass mustard anymore. And if anything, the federal government's being much stricter with how they're viewing those enrollment periods and allowing people to get insured outside of the open enrollment period.
Is it easy for people to make that transition? Where you talked about life changes, like let's say somebody was making X number of dollars a year and they had a subsidy, but then they lost their job or something. Is it easy for them to make the transition that, oh my God, now I've got to go to Medicaid or something like that? Is it easy to, I know you've been fine tuning the system over the last 4 or 5 years, but the actual, mechanics of calling and getting a hold of you guys to say, I've got a really dramatic change in my income and I need to change my policies. Is that easy to do?
Yeah, so it's much easier to do than it used to be. I would, there is no system that's perfect, but it's much easier than it used to be. I think the other thing that's interesting too is that we have more insurance companies now, or at least in our state, we have insurance companies, and I'll just use Molina as an example, who have products that are both Medicaid as well as for purchase on the exchange. And so for those individuals, it may be the case where they could actually move within the same carrier. So it's mm-hmm. not as hard. And we do get individuals that are termed the churn population that will move over the course of the year, either from Medicaid up to purchasing insurance or from purchasing insurance back to Medicaid, depending on what they do. And I'm sure, you might be aware of that because of being in Spokane, you've got a lot of farmers, people have very cyclical income. So maybe certain months they're making a lot of money and other months they're not making as much. And so we'll see a lot of that movement between both programs. And it is easier to do now, both executionally and operationally, than it's ever been before.
So this one says, Stephen Brill, I'm not sure who that is, and others have written about the massive discrepancies in the cost of procedures like surgery based on locale and specific facilities and the inadequate cost controls in the Affordable Care Act. What is Washington State doing about this and what can and should be done? Are you guys familiar with what that issue is? I'm not.
Basically, it's the story I like to tell is I had a dog who was very active and he tore his ACL. And when he tore his ACL, he was going to need surgery. He's still pretty young, so he was a very good candidate to get ACL replaced, get it fixed. Now, for me to get my dog to get ACL surgery, all I had to do was go price it out. There's total price transparency. You can go anywhere and just figure out how much it was. and, you know, get it fixed. And that's what I did, got a good doctor, got it fixed, all that's good. What Stephen Brill points out is that someone can get an MRI. It's the same MRI at the same facility. One insurance company may charge, I don't know, I'll make up numbers now, $100. Another's gonna charge 10 grand. Why? Why is that happening?
Good question, yeah.
And that's where I push myself away from the microphone and let someone else handle the rest of the question, because I okay. actually don't know.
Mike or Elaine,
you know,
do you guys know?
I think it's really quite an interesting phenomenon that you can wind up. I mean, Stephen Brill's written about it. Atul Gawande is another one that's written about the same topic in comparable communities in Texas. And the huge variation that you had from one community to another. And what I've always have found interesting is that once you start to really show the providers that they're out of line with their peers in another community for exactly the same procedure, it's remarkable how they start to adjust, and all of a sudden it starts to come down for the same procedure. It just becomes the kind of the standard of care in that community, that this is how what they do and what they wind up charging, and frequently it's way out of line with what you can justify, and sometimes it's only a matter of going a few miles and finding a different community that can have that kind of variation. But that's one that one of the things that I think is going to make a big difference is in the state of Washington is that we have the all-payer database now that is going to have some real influence from the standpoint of being able to go in and take a look and see, okay, how much are the reimbursements for particular procedures in the state of Washington? And if you find some providers that are way out of line, it doesn't take much to show them that, whether it's a surgeon or any other physician, you put that in front of them and they're gonna say, whoa, maybe I need to rethink how and what I'm ordering right now in the way of procedures or procedures I'm performing.
Yeah, and is that part of the problem, Elaine? In other words, I mean, I hear this from people that I know that have had, you know, various procedures done. They say, geez, I tried to get information from the doctors, you know, as I was going to go in and say, do you know how much is this going to cost? And it's just, it seems like a super confusing path to who do you talk to about that? I mean, can you give us some insight on that?
It is very confusing, and it's very, very difficult. And I will welcome the day when we have transparency around all of those pieces, because people should know what it's going to cost them. The, you know, another issue that we do have, however, is that we negotiate with several different insurance carriers, and every single insurance carrier is going to want to pay us differently based on the site of location. So an example that I can give you is that even though we have a ambulatory surgery center that does not get paid for being a hospital setting, we had an insurance carrier who would not recognize that that site, and it was more, and so for the person that was getting it, they couldn't go to our ambulatory surgery center because the insurance company would not cover that, but they would cover 100% at the, or 80% at the hospital-based facility. So that's one of the issues that we have. Another issue that we have is that when you go ahead and you think about the MRI that is located in an ambulatory site does not have to cover the costs for having a 24-hour emergency department, having behavioral health that may not be covered, a variety of those other kinds of things. So I think that that's sometimes where you can get these prices. Now, when you have a price that's $100 and a price that's $10,000, that is, I think, in the pricing transparency where you can get those, you know, those prices closer together. Mm-hmm. But there's so many factors in terms of what is going on. And I do think that pricing transparency, which I know that we've been having conversations with the Washington State Hospital Association, has been having conversations with the state in terms of what would that look like.
You're listening to the Health Forum, Navigating the Healthcare Maze on Spokane Public Radio.
So this next question that was on the same card is going to lead perfectly into one of my sub-panelists, and that would be Jessa Lewis, who's sitting in the audience. So, and Jessa, this was just somebody in the audience wrote this, but this ties in well with your efforts. So if you want to come up, this person had asked, what are the prospects for a statewide system with universal coverage? Couldn't we save a lot of money on marketing and advertising, processing claim forms, pharmaceutical costs, and administrative overhead in general? So just to introduce Jessa Lewis to you here, who is one of our other sub-panelists, she is with the group Healthcare for All, and they have been working to lobby legislators to try to take a look at least the single-payer concept in the Washington legislature. And you were busy over there this session talking to lawmakers. What were the proposals that you had before them? And I think both died in committee, but you did have some good news at the end. What were the main proposals you were trying to work on?
Yes, with both House Bill HB 1026 and Senate Bill 5701, we were looking at creating a 9-person panel to create what would be a single purchaser system. So there would still be private care, hospitals would still exist as they are, but the payment structure would be streamlined to where we'd have set prices, we'd have set exactly what would be the care items that everyone would have access to. And similar to Medicare, someone could purchase a supplemental plan to cover anything further that's not under that basic care. There's been other studies done to where they suggest such a system would create a $9 million savings in the state. But what we were able to accomplish this year was we got a budget proviso to do a study with the Washington State Institute for Public Policy for $100,000 to see exactly what the various options for funding and structure that would be in order to propose new bills next year. We were just a couple of votes shy, so anywhere between 4 to 6, we think, of getting it passed in the legislature between both chambers. And without those votes, we weren't able to get it out of committee.
And so I should have probably asked initially, the basic definition of single payer, it's like your insurance premium, as it were, would come out of your paycheck or some. Is that kind of the mechanism for it? Or what are the main benefits of what we are hearing as single payer? What is it?
And what we're looking at is exactly what is going to be the most effective mechanism in order to deliver that. Because one of the things is we're looking at for small businesses and large corporations is that a lot of their bottom line is impacted by the cost of care. So having employment, having your insurance tied to employment sets it up to where if you lose your insurance when you're sick, then you have trouble accessing care. Maybe you don't leave a job and you stay at a job that you're not necessarily happy to be at because you don't know what you'd be able to secure otherwise. And that is a system that has definitely driven up the costs. And so what we'd like to see is with a single purchaser that your care is no longer connected to where you work or if you work and how much you're paid.
Mm-hmm. When I read this question, when it talked about marketing and advertising, processing claim forms, and even pharmaceutical costs, would these be things that would be improved by that type of a system?
Absolutely. So most figures say about 33 cents out of every dollar that we spend on healthcare is wasted in this overhead. And by cutting that and streamlining it, we would be able to cover everyone for much less.
And you, at the final thing you said was there that you did get some money to initiate some sort of a study, correct?
Yes, we've partnered with the legislature, and they're going to be, and I appreciate, I want to thank Mike for your help in talking to us, and I'm looking forward to what we can actually see and propose next session. And it is our plan as an organization that if we do not get something passed next session, we'd like to take what we learned from that and put it to an initiative as well.
Okay, so if people have questions, they can maybe look at your website, Healthcare for All. Is that
yes,
correct?
Yes, please. Healthcareforallwa.org. And also feel free to reach out to me, Jessa Lewis, and we'd love to answer your questions or come speak to any of your neighborhood groups.
Okay. And when you guys on the panel hear that about the single payer concept, I mean, do you have concerns or what's your general read? I just want to get, you know, from you folks in the industry, what do you think about when you hear single payer? Do you have special concerns that it might not be the big panacea that we're hearing, or?
I guess I'm a little bit more of a political realist. I just realized how difficult it was to get the Affordable Care Act passed, which is, so to speak, competition among health insurance. From a practical standpoint of where I'm at, it would have been infinitely easier to implement a single-payer system, such as the expansion of Medicare to all for all, as opposed to the system that we have right now. I mean, this is one where you're constantly trying to make sure that everybody's competing on a level platform, and it's not easy. It's a real challenge to make sure that everybody is playing with the same set of rules, and that's with a single payer system, that it would have been infinitely easier to do it. From a political standpoint, you had a huge challenge to be able to wind up passing the Affordable Care Act. I think you may remember there wasn't a single Republican vote. It was all Democrat vote that carried the Affordable Care Act at the time. So the idea of being able to go beyond that to a single-payer system, I think, is a bit of a challenge. But I think there's growing frustration. I think, you know, for one thing, you're seeing a significant amount of consolidation among health insurance companies in this country, which obviously does not portend well for competition. Quite frankly, the expanded affiliation of hospitals across this country is also having an impact on competition as we know it. I'm not sure that with what's happening with the insurance companies and what's happening with the providers, that we're not matriculating to a single payer system out of necessity because of the changes in the system that are taking place as we speak.
And when you, and I'm going to get to you guys shortly too, but I was going to say, when you talk about the single payer system, wasn't there some sort of proviso under ACA that allowed states to sort of consider that? I mean, that's how we got to this point where you can talk about it, correct? It's like an option under ACA?
That was one of the things we were looking at with the 1332 waiver under the ACA, but that is something to where there's some concerns over what would be, how that would be structured, would we be allowed to do that? And so we're appreciative of, there's some work happening in Congress with friends of ours who are putting bills forward, hopefully soon, that will set it up to where it'll be easier for states to innovate.
Okay. Let's take one more of one of you two folks' questions. Yeah, come on up. Just make it brief. I don't want to go too long. I've got another sub-panelist that I want to get to here pretty quick, so go ahead.
Okay. First of all, I want to know why we are so insurance-obsessed. This is about healthcare. It's not about insurance. It's not about marketing, and it's not about money. I would recommend anybody in the room to read the book, if they haven't already, The Healing of America by Tim Reed. It was written about 20 years ago, and it's still relevant. My background is that I lived overseas for 17 years in a country that had mandated coverage, not insurance. There were people who bought insurance. There was no interference of insurance or government on my health choices with my doctor. There was portability. That means that when I moved jobs, I took my choice of insurance with me, or not insurance, coverage with me. And my employer had to give me what my choice was. There was a low premium. I never paid more than $23 a month.
And where were you at?
I'll tell you in a minute. Okay. That, then it's on purpose.
Yeah.
This was shared also by the government and the employer. And they had a birth-to-death national insurance, which is like birth-to-death Social Security, that covered this if you were unemployed. There was no cost for hospitalization and no cost for chronic or catastrophic disease. Now, insurance companies started this whole mess. And the downward spiral that we're in now, we're expected to buy insurance. It's like taking poison to treat poison. This is insanity. It's a lobbyist's dream. Single payer is not working in the United Kingdom. Friends that lived with me over there are back in the United Kingdom, and they wait 3 years for surgeries. I got sick in Britain one time, and it was a nightmare. They are forced to buy supplementary insurance because they can't get any satisfaction from their insurance there. The bureaucracy is tangled. why hasn't anyone paid attention to or talked about Israel, their Kupat Holim, or sick coverage system, when Israel is one of the world's most advanced medical systems, and they're the first responders to almost every world disaster, health disaster? I'm floored by this.
Okay.
We're stuck.
Okay, great. Good information. Do you guys know much about the Israeli plan or how they do that or anything? Or, I mean, I'm guessing they're financing it through a lot of tax. I don't know. When we talk about single payer and these new systems, I mean, would there be a way to not have an insurance covering this kind of stuff? Or is this just, you know, do you guys have any kind of reaction?
I mean, if you do it like Medicare, I mean, mm-hmm. and just expand out Medicare for all, it's obviously one way of being able to make sure that everybody gets coverage. It doesn't mean that you're totally free of not having some auxiliary cost, which is why you have supplemental Medicaid coverage policies and the like. But at the same time, it's not the kind of insurance that you think of like you do right now, whether it's a Blues plan or a Kaiser or whatever.
Okay, and we're going to hear from an expert on Medicare just here in a second. One more thing I want to ask, because this kind of went with what she just said, and maybe you don't have an answer to this, but again, this is an audience question. If each of the panel could wave their magic wand, what healthcare model from around the world would you recommend for the USA? So in other words, I guess, are there any other models that you think are good? And then they put Finland is the happiest population in the world, but I don't know if that has to do with their medical care. And Israel is number two, she says.
Ten.
Number 10, okay.
Which beats America at 14.
Okay, thank you. So anyway, any ideas on that, or is that just no opinions?
Yeah, I'm just, you know, I'm a simple politician here. I'm trying just to try to get enough votes so that we make sure that we're starting to address what is a pronounced problem that we've got right now of trying to make sure people have access to insurance. The ACA, I think we all agree, is far from perfect, but it's certainly a whole lot better than what we had before. So why don't we work at trying to make it work better rather than trying to find something totally new? Because I think it's going to be extremely difficult to come back and be able to go directly to a single payer system at this point. Mm-hmm. However, I have to say that even among the health insurance companies, there's a fair amount of nervousness on their part that if the current administration had succeeded in eliminating the Affordable Care Act, it wouldn't have taken too long before there would have been hell to pay and they'd have been coming back with another solution, and it wouldn't have been the Affordable Care Act. It would have been a single payer system, and I think it would have probably stuck.
Yeah, what can I ask you maybe some more specifics about that Republican plan that died in both the House and Senate versions? About, was there anything in those plans that you on the panel thought were workable ideas, or was it just a complete mistake from your opinion?
Well, one of the true ironies is that the Affordable Care Act passed in 2010. And they'd had a full year before that where they could kind of gin up their arguments as to what they wanted as an alternative. They wind up then getting control of both chambers of Congress and the presidency, and you'd think they would have hit the ground running. There's reasons why, and the president said it. It's who knew it was so difficult or complex? And a lot of us that have been around it for a long time knew it was very complex and it was not going to be a simple solution.
Right.
And their solutions were simplistic at best and certainly wouldn't have addressed what people... Trying to make sure that you had coverage for pre-existing conditions. You heard time and time again, we want to make sure that it covers pre-existing conditions. And every plan they put out there did not maintain that you could keep your coverage or acquire coverage if you had a pre-existing condition. I mean, you just push back.
Michael.
Yeah, one of the things I think that, you know, I think it's hard because people sometimes forget is that it took us a lot of years to get to the situation we are with our healthcare system before the ACA. 5 years of the ACA is not going to cure all the ills that are in the system. It's just not feasible. The other thing is that, and it's unfortunate, is that we happen to live in a day and age where the polarity between the parties that are in charge is so bad that, you know, I think of the good old days when, you know, a bill would have been passed and there would have been a year spent analyzing how it's doing, and then people would have fixed stuff in it. And we wouldn't, you know, they would have looked at the ACA. They actually would have made changes. People would have agreed on stuff to get changed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Tip O'Neill and Ron Reagan are going out and having scotch and things are getting done.
Yeah.
That doesn't happen anymore. There's just such animosity. Everyone wants their way or the highway. And it's just a really lousy way to solve problems, particularly problems as big as the ones we're seeing today.
Elaine.
I think that one of the things that has happened in healthcare, I do agree that our healthcare system is broken. We don't have the evidence-based outcomes that some of these other countries have. And
what does that mean, evidence-based outcome?
When you look at like the, you know, our the people in the United States don't have probably the longevity that some of the other countries are. When you look at babies that are born, you know, we have more of neonatal issues than what some of those other countries do.
Sure.
So, you know, I totally think that our healthcare system, we need to go ahead and transform it. And there are a lot of things that are happening in the transformation of healthcare. One of the things that has happened over the last several years is that we recognize that more evidence-based practices got to come into play, not only in a hospital setting, but also into a primary care piece. And we need to have people become more accountable also for their own health care. When you think about health care, I think sometimes people define it as what happens in a hospital. It's not what happens in a hospital. It is also that we know, and in fact, we know this even in Spokane, that depending on what your zip code is probably more of an indication of what your health outcome is going to be than your genetic code. And so how is it that we develop healthcare policy that begins to go ahead and look at how are we going to get upstream from some of the issues and really look at population health in a different way and really begin to talk about those types of things? You know, a child born today is going to have a less of a, they're not going to live as long as their parents before them today. And that is, you know, that's a travesty. Oh. And what we need to do, and when you think about it, we've got obesity issues, we've got diabetes issues, we've got lung, you know, with lung cancers and all of those other kinds of things due to the lifestyles that we've got in the United States. And I think that we've got to begin to start thinking about where are those. We know that fresh food is an important part. We need to make certain that people have access to food, that they have access to behavioral health services, you know, a variety of these other kinds of things in order for them to live, work, and play in a community and be healthy. And so what does health mean? And I think that, you know, some of the other things that we're going to be dealing with into the future is if we don't address, for example, when I went to school, PE was required every single day. And now PE is not required. It was required in high school all the way through, you know, 4 years of high school, which then sets up a different lifestyle. And we're not, you know, those are the kinds of things that have gone away, but they're really important social determinants of health that really do matter in terms of what people's health outcomes are. So I think that that's one thing that we need to look at. In addition to that, I think that some of the other things that we need to begin to look at is really focusing in on, you know, population health. How do we go ahead and take care of ourselves? You know, maybe some of this stuff has to be legislated, and we need to really get. I mean, I love the thing about, you know, help. Let's help save Idaho. We can help save ourselves as well. And then the other piece that we need to continue to focus in on is where are the, instead of, you know, before in the insurance companies in the 1960s, I think, when I first got out of, well, I wasn't in nursing yet then, I was still a baby, but when we went and we were being paid, we paid everybody based on how much they did, so it was all based on volume versus value. And we're really, we're starting to transcend that now. And we're starting to say is that we're going to get paid for outcomes versus doing more.
Oh, okay.
You know, and that's evidence-based practice. We don't need to do, you know, physicians used to get paid a lot on how much of something that they did. So, right. You know, you did more x-rays, you got paid more money. That was how that was. And now we know that, you know, x-rays for backs and back pain is not something that is going to change the way that people are taken care of. So what is the evidence on that? And we need to really go to a value-based program in terms of our payments. And those are some of the transformations that are occurring. And I remember, again, when I was first out of school in the 1990s, is it was that hospitals were going to be the one-stop shopping for all healthcare. Hospitals are only a nano of what we provide. You know, there are many, many people today who went ahead and had healthcare of some kind. Either they went out and they sought it themselves, may have gone to a primary care physician, may have had a lab test, or just a variety of things. Maybe read a book. A hospital is not going to do that. The hospital, the acute care hospital, is there for when you have an emergency, you've got a brain tumor, you've got cancer, you've got some of those other things. But we need to start looking at where's the population at, how do we get upstream from these kinds of things, really looking at where the zip codes are, what are the things that we can impact in terms of really making certain that we've got a healthy population.
You're listening to Spokane Public Radio's annual Health Forum.
Now, I wanted to get to my final sub-panelist, and then, sir, I promise you're going to get up next. So we talked about Medicaid and the coverage from an insurance company, but again, millions of Americans get their current health coverage from Medicare. So many in our audience, including myself here, may be nearing the age when they need to know more about it. I know it's kind of been a dynamic process that's been changing. So in our audience, we have Dennis Fletcher, who's an agent who specializes in Medicare. Dennis, can you get up and maybe all I need to maybe give, if you can give us a brief overview of the various types of Medicare coverage and maybe give us a clue how that works?
Okay.
Maybe a lot of people know this already.
One of the things that I like about Medicare, it's pretty consistent that you really can't charge more than what you think you're going to get because Medicare has what they call the assignment number. And so if somebody wants to charge their $10,000, they can go ahead and charge it, but Medicare's going to say we're only going to pay $300. Oh. So, you know, that's one of the beauties of Medicare. It's pretty much consistent all the way across the board. There's really two different aspects of Medicare. There's Medicare supplements and Medicare Advantage. In the state of Washington, we're really lucky because you can switch back and forth. We have portability, which is really, really effective. So people can buy a Medicare Advantage plan in the beginning, and as they get older, then they can move to a Medicare supplement under the current rules. And that was brought in before your time. So, you know, it's been very, very fortunate for us. So Medicare Advantage is something that I think is very, very impressive and very good because what it does is allows the insurance company to kind of get involved in your life a little bit. Understand when Medicare Advantage is paid for, it's paid for by the government. They receive the premiums from the government, somewhere between $8,000 and $12,000, depending on the county you live in, per year. And so they can charge $0, $17, $24 per situation. And they take all the risks. So their whole program is, we need to keep you healthy, because if they have a $1 million claim, guess who pays the claim? The insurance company does. Whereas with Medicare, the government will pay Medicare the premium instead, and then they will pay 80% of the claim minus any deductibles. Mm-hmm. And so if it's a $1 million claim, the government will pay 80%, and either the insurance company or yourself will pay the other 20. Whereas a Medicare Advantage plan, the insurance company's got to pay the full $1 million. Well, it's never $1 million because there is the Medicare assignment number that comes out of that. But so I'm a big proponent of either or. Let the client figure out which plan is best for them. If you're chronic, obviously Medicare Advantage, it may not be the best choice for you, and Medicare supplements might be a good move. And if you're very, very healthy, Medicare Advantage plan might be a better choice, because with your Medicare Advantage plans, you get the full physicals, you get the vision, you get the hearing, you get the gym membership. One of the big things I've seen coming out of that is trying to keep people healthy. Star ratings have become a huge number, and I think star ratings are now filtering down to the doctors.
Yes.
Is that correct? A star rating is such that the more stars you have, the more money you're going to receive. And I think with the doctors, the more stars you have, the higher the reimbursement, correct?
Correct.
And then which is your healthcare, you know, outcome-based situation. I think that's a tremendous, tremendous tool now.
You know, those essentials that were covered by ACA, the 10 or whatever, 12 essentials, that was one of the questions here. I mean, all those things were covered by Medicare, right? And were there any limits to coverage of like $1 million or any of this, or was this always in those Medicare plans?
Well, originally Medicare Advantage has started as a, was not a good product. When Medicare, we started in this business in 2006 when the prescription drug plans came out.
Okay.
And all of a sudden we were sitting at Walmart and next thing I knew I had 7,200 clients and we knew nothing about Medicare. We took a look at Medicare Advantage back then and took the Medicare supplements, and we wouldn't touch Medicare Advantage. One company, national company, would not. All these Medicare Advantage plans have out-of-pocket maximums. Well, this particular company would not have an out-of-pocket maximum for cancer, any chemotherapy or radiation.
Mm.
And they came into my office and they said, why did you not sell this plan? And I said, look at page 94 of your contract, and it just said there that the out-of-pocket maximum did not apply to chemotherapy and or radiation.
Oh.
And so we wouldn't sell it. We didn't sell a Medicare Advantage plan until 2009, 2010. They really evolving in 2012, 2013, to where they became very, very good products. And so we were selling a lot of supplements back then. Now we've kind of rolled into a Medicare Advantage plan because of the cost factor to the seniors. Somebody could make, with a supplement, you could pay $130,000 in Idaho. Just look at that number. Somebody could pay an extra $130,000 for a supplement over there because they're, instead of community rated, they're age-based. So when you're 86 years old, you're paying $340 and $360 for a Plan F. And at that point in time, you're better off in a Medicare Advantage plan because the out-of-pocket maximums are right there at the premium.
Okay.
And so over there, you can't switch back and forth. And here, if you're sick, you can go from a Medicare Advantage plan the following year to a Medicare supplement, and we can cut you off at the knees as far as, instead of paying $67,000 to $7,000 out-of-pocket, we could limit you to $1,800 to $2,000 or $3,000 in there. And so we work real hard with the doctors through Cancer Care Northwest, the dialysis clinic, and they'll call us when they have a problem. They'll, you know, during open enrollment, we'll move back and forth. I don't know if that's a good thing or not, but it's good for the client. And the one thing about state of Washington, we're really lucky because we do have portability. That is so key. In Idaho, I'm seeing people that's 80 years old playing a Plan F at $390, $400, and in Washington State, we're paying $210, $220.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and although in Idaho they'll start at 140 and they'll grow, by the time they hit 70, 75, they're paying, you know, 250, a lot more than they're paying here. So it's really community rated, because a 90-year-old will pay 215, 216, and a 65-year-old will pay 215, 216. It's the same rate.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, in Idaho, 149 to 300, 350, somewhere in there. Okay. So when people come to us, we just take a look at their situation and we decide. You know, we show them both sides of the product, and they can decide themselves. We just educate them. We're a education and service company. We just know if we educate them well enough and explain the programs to them well enough, then they're going to pick their own plan, and they can decide which direction they want to go.
Okay.
So that's really how it works.
Great. Dennis, thanks for your update on that.
You bet.
Thanks so much. This gentleman has been waiting patiently for the longest time, and I guess I should tell everybody we've got about 12 minutes now, so we'll try to get through. No, you guys will be fine.
I'll be just fine.
And we'll try to get through as many cards as we can. Go ahead.
Great. I'm Kurt Fackler, and I'm the Navigator Program Manager for Better Health Together. So we're the organization that tries to sign everybody up for the Affordable Care Act.
So you're one of the navigators.
Yes, and
okay.
I actually run the program.
Right.
And one of the most difficult things we have right now is the networks, and you've talked a little bit about it earlier. And I just want to know some of your suggestions. A lot of times we have families that there is not one doctor that they all go to. And so again, and I know this year you had a big discussion with one of the QHP carriers about network adequacy. And as the insurance commissioner, that's one of your jobs, is to make sure. What are you looking in the future? And I think my thing is more information to the client to make sure. So do you have anything on the books, or what are you thinking about?
The challenge is going to continue to be is to be able to review those networks and make sure they're performing. And we've made several improvements, not the least of which is that we have it now so that they have to keep their network up to date. Throughout a policy year in the individual market, there may be significant changes in those networks. Now they have to keep not only us fully informed, but it's information that's fully available then to the individual so that they know what the network winds up looking like going forward. And that type of IT intervention is something that's relatively new now that we have available to us. But it's going to be, it's been a huge learning experience. So we wound up as for 2015, the only state in the nation that established network adequacy standards for these, specifically targeting these narrow networks so that we had a better understanding of what they were doing with these narrow networks so that they weren't shortchanging individuals. And one of the issues that we did have here recently was that a carrier was giving us attestations. We don't have enough staff so we can go out and go into doctor's offices and find out who they have under contract. We go to the insurance company, and if we rely on them telling us everything that's accurate and complete about their network. And if they're not, this is one where we need to step in with enforcement action. So it's one where we're continually working to make sure that we are as up to date as possible, and at the same time holding every insurance company to a common standard. The worst thing we can do is allow somebody to play fast and loose. I think that was one of the real challenges, particularly for some of the Medicaid carriers who had never been in the commercial market, who then went into the commercial market as a part of dealing with churn and coming in and out. And the Medicaid program for the state through the Health Care Authority, and it was true in a number of states, we're trying to encourage that the Medicaid carriers would offer in the commercial market too. What we found is that a number of those Medicaid carriers were not prepared to go into the commercial market. They didn't understand that they had to have different rates. Their networks for Medicaid were not going to be the same networks that would apply. It was very difficult to go to the hospital and tell them, oh, and by the way, we'll give you a reimbursement. It'll only be comparable to the Medicaid program. Most of the hospitals would have said, not at our hospital. We'll do Medicaid because we see it as part of our social responsibility, but you can't carry that over into the commercial market.
Yeah, that's one of our biggest frustrations. We talked earlier about switching from Medicaid, so they'll have a Medicaid provider, and they also do a qualified health plan, but they have to end up changing doctors because those aren't the same networks, even though it's the same insurance company. So that's a huge frustration.
Okay. Thanks for your question. Ma'am, come on up. We'll try to get you in, and we've got, it looks like about 7 minutes now, so if you can answer her question, then maybe I'll have one more final question for you guys.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you. I have lots of questions, but I will limit myself, of course. So I'm originally from Canada, so I've lived under the one-payer system for 35, 40 years. So then I moved to the US, and it took me a while to catch up on how the system works here. I've been self-employed for the last 10 to 12 years. I'm a CPA, so I work with numbers. And one thing that I'm certainly in favor of Obamacare, of one single payer system, of the public option. It's too bad that didn't pass through. We could do like Clinton suggested. We lower the Medicare age to 55 or 60 to help people in my age bracket. So, which brings me, Mr. Kreidler, to my current comment and question about healthcare premium for people in Washington. I'm self-employed, so I always look at what's my maximum out of pocket. That's why I buy health insurance, is because I don't want to go bankrupt, right? So I go for the cheapest premium because I'm generally healthy and very proactive. Last year, my premium went from $375 per month with a $7,000 deductible to the same plan, $599 in 2017. So I calculated that's a 59-point-something% increase. So premiums are going incredibly up for certain people in Washington. And the deductibles, I mean, I've been self-employed, so I've seen all of that go up and up and up. And you're like, okay, you know, and then this eats, the premium eats your income. And then I am thankful I am not sick, so I don't have to spend the other $7,000 for a chronic illness, because then I would be like $15,000 after-tax dollars, which means probably $20,000 just for like little me, not my family, not my husband, to pay for our health care, just basics. And so I don't know. To me, that's a lot of money, and that's a big increase, you know? And so I just want, you know, you to be aware of that at a certain age range, and also other people, you know, that are in their 40s, 30s, people who are self-employed. And
I'm sorry to speed you up, but we probably only have about 4 minutes. So, Mike, could you just maybe make a quick comment, and then we'll probably have to sign off.
Sure.
Because we're getting near the end. Thanks for waiting so long.
Yeah, thank you. Should I sit down?
Clearly,
the group that I'm most worried about right now are the people who don't receive any subsidy. They're the ones that are seeing significant rate increases. And they've gone up much more rapidly because of what's happening at the national level. When you knock out the CSR fundings, your cost-sharing reductions, that had a negative impact on the cost of health care. When you take out the individual mandate, that has a negative impact on the cost of health care. You don't have any longer a program that was in effect for the first 3 years in 14, 15, and 16. You don't have it now in 17, or now in 18, and that is the reinsurance program, which had a very substantial impact positively in helping to hold down rate increases. So one of the real shortcomings right now and the challenges is what are we going to do about these individuals who don't qualify for any kind of financial assistance? It's one of the ironies is our health insurance exchange, and I think it's a credit to the information technology and the shopping experience that they offer. We're at actually a little over 40% now of the enrollees inside the exchange don't receive any subsidy.
Mm-hmm.
They buy there because it's an easy, convenient way to buy health insurance, and I think that's quite different. In fact, that might be the highest number outside of Washington, D.C., because that's the only place you can buy an individual policy in Washington, D.C. But for other states, it's probably the highest percentage of non-subsidized people in the exchange of any state in the nation. So they, but it's still one we've got to do better. There's no question.
And Michael Marchand, maybe we've only got maybe a minute or so, but we talked about this earlier about the fact that the silver plans did dramatically increase this year while the bronze didn't. It had to do with that cost sharing thing.
Mm-hmm.
That he was talking about. Oh, is it? Okay. Okay. Yeah.
I think as the commissioner alluded to, The rates set by the insurance companies are disproportionately weighed against, you know, depending on your age, because, you know, again, they're playing against risk, and they know that there are certain age groups that have high risk because you utilize more healthcare. So, you know, the commissioner's spot on. We've been working very closely with the OIC and the healthcare authority, as well as the governor's office and involve legislators to see how we can address this issue of affordability. Affordability is key mission, you know, at the exchange. We want to be involved in those conversations. I know the commissioner has been doing his due diligence both here and in the other Washington to get work done on that. And we hear about it all the time. And, you know, it's something that we've taken to the legislature. We've taken in groups, and I know it's something we'll continue to work on because there, you know, we got to do better on it, as the commissioner said.
Okay, great. And thanks to everybody who were able to ask questions. And sorry if we didn't get to all of them. We try to get as many of those in as we can, and I think we got most of them. So I'd like to thank you all for attending our annual Spokane Public Radio Health Forum event, Living in the Healthcare Maze. And thanks to our panelists here, Washington Insurance Commissioner Mike Kreidler, Michael Marchand of the Washington State Benefit Exchange, Elaine Couture of Providence Healthcare, Aaron Wilson, the CEO of Community Health Association of Spokane, or CHAS, Jessa Lewis with Healthcare for All, Tim Jordan from Reclaim Idaho, insurance agent Dennis Fletcher, also the staff and volunteers of Spokane Public Radio, John DeLay of Spokane City Cable 5, and thanks to, again to our event donors, Washington State University Health Sciences Spokane, the Journal of Business, Providence Health and Services, and 6th Avenue Medical Pharmacy. Also thanks to our audience again for coming down tonight and posing such good questions.
The broadcast of Spokane Public Radio's Health Forum is underwritten by the Journal of Business, the Inland Northwest's source for local business news, serving the local business community in print, online, and on the go, SpokaneJournal.com. By Providence Healthcare, serving the region for generations through knowledge, skills, and caregivers dedicated to helping create healthier communities together. Information at phc.org. By the 6th Avenue Medical Pharmacy, a full-service pharmacy since 1964, providing prescriptions, custom compounding for people and animals, custom packaging, and travel vaccines. And WSU Health Sciences Spokane, dedicated to changing people's lives by educating medical professionals in the colleges of medicine, nursing, and pharmacy. More at spokane.wsu.edu.